Good afternoon, and welcome to the Sunday edition of the Secular Foxhole Podcast. Today, Martin and I have two very special guests, Margaret Downey of the Free Thought Society and Andrew Seidel of the Freedom From Religion Foundation are both here to discuss Thomas Paine and other issues that might crop up during the conversation. Andrew, Margaret, are you there?
Yes, thank you so much for hosting us. I'm looking forward to this discussion of my very favorite free thought hero, Thomas Paine.
As am I. It's a pleasure to be joining you.
And I'm here also, Blair.
Oh, yes. I did mention you, Martin. Can I ask each of our guests, Margaret, can you go first to describe briefly the Free Thought Society?
Oh, yes. We are a 501c3 educational nonprofit organization. We are close to our 30-year anniversary of establishing ourselves. We started in Pennsylvania, but we have grown tremendously. We started as a chapter of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, but we mutually decided to go ahead and get bigger, and we grew now to be a national presence. We are not a competitive organization. We are a cooperative organization. So we do a lot of events with cooperating organizations such as the Freedom From Religion Foundation. That's why I'm so happy that Andrew has joined us today.
Well, great. Go ahead, Andrew.
I love the Free Thought Society. It does wonderful work. I'm here representing the Freedom From Religion Foundation. We are a national nonprofit. We were founded in 1976. And we have two basic purposes. We work to educate and to separate. So to educate the public about what it is to be a non-believer in the United States, and then to keep state and church separate. So we've got a team of 10 attorneys on staff who take cases and work to make sure that, for instance, you know, kindergarten teachers aren't telling kids that they have to pray before they walk down to lunch in our public schools. We have about 33,000 members. That's how we get all of our funding. And we get about anywhere between 3,000 and 5,000 state church complaints that our legal team handles every single year.
Wow.
I'm the director of strategic response at FFRF, which is just a completely made up title. It was a placeholder in a memo I wrote, and then it stuck. I'm also a constitutional attorney and author, and I've been with FFRF for coming up on 10 years now.
You get the title instead of the money. That's
yeah, that's the deal of working in a nonprofit.
Well, it's in the corporate world too, believe me. Sometimes, anyway. But, both of these organizations I'm familiar with, actually. And today we are going to talk about, you have some exciting news about Thomas Paine, I understand.
Yes.
Who wants to jump in there?
Margaret does.
Oh, yes. I thank you so much, Andrew, for letting me speak first. We have a newly formed 501c3 organization entitled Thomas Paine Memorial Association. And we are striving to put statues of Thomas Paine in the major points in his life where he lived and worked. Particularly, we want to have a statue in Washington, D.C. But we're also looking at Philadelphia and New York and other locations. And Andrew Seidel is the treasurer of this newly formed 501c3 organization.
Great. Well, of course, for me, it all started with common sense as far as the revolutionary era. I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, prior to that, there was very little, how do I want to phrase it? People thought of themselves as serfs or part of the monarchy or part, you know, they didn't think of themselves as individuals until that pamphlet came out. Is that more or less correct?
Yes, it started people thinking about their position, their freedoms, the Enlightenment era of using reason and common sense to declare freedom from the crown, and talking about, you know, forming a more perfect union through this revolutionary thought process outlined in common sense. Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense in the Philadelphia area. And the pamphlet sold so much that in today's world, it would be worth millions. But what Thomas Paine did so graciously and admirably is that he gave all the profits towards the effort of the Revolutionary War.
I didn't know that. That's great.
Yeah, he didn't make any money off of it. He which came back to hurt him later on in life. He kind of ended the Revolutionary War in poverty. But I mean, it really, I think you're right to point to how influential it was. It was certainly instrumental in the colony's Declaration of Independence, which came 6 months later. And I think prior to Common Sense, you had not seen anybody attempt to clearly and concisely call for independence, champion a democratic government, champion enlightenment values and equal rights in language that anybody could understand. Certainly there had been talk about it among, you know, political philosophers and the elites of the time, but nothing on this level. And that's why everybody read it or had it read to them. I mean, it was at the time the most widely read pamphlet. It had a massive influence on the not just the American psyche during the war, but the formation of the American identity at the time, and which we look back on now.
And I have the statistics actually right in front of me. 120,000 copies of Common Sense were sold in the first 3 months of its publication. And at the end of the revolution, 500,000 copies had been sold. So that means that about 20% of colonists owned a copy of Common Sense.
And I believe, Margaret, those numbers are just the licit copies. Not there's a number of printers who fucked up and illegally started doing it. They started adding some words. So yeah, I mean, it was amazingly widespread, especially for the time.
And it's still selling. I recently bought one in Swedish on Rights of Man. And then I listened to a podcast that Blair also have listened to on Writ Large podcast with Zachary Davis and his guests. And there, a person from American history in Stanford talks about, as you said, the common language. So you understand it, the common man and the individual. And also that he was going from England, coming to the colonies, and then thinking, so to speak, out of the box, and then created this nature world, you could say, that you are a member of it, an independent member. So, and they said a funny thing there. Think if Thomas Paine had used modern technology today, for example, like Twitter, how that could have spread in a good way. So could you reflect on that in modern day, your work, what you're trying to separate church and state or religion and state, and also that we are individuals? Because I watched here in Sweden lives, the inauguration, and then Biden almost started with under God.
Yes.
Could you comment on that? And also look into the future when these great statues, and because it's a symbolic thing to put the stature on historical places, so people could, you know, wake up a bit maybe, or reflect or think about it.
Yes. Separation of religion and government was important to Thomas Paine. Mm-hmm. And we do, as a matter of fact, there are several statues of Thomas Paine at the present time.
Okay.
An interesting little fact is that Napoleon Bonaparte actually said that there should be a golden statue of Thomas Paine in every city in the universe.
Oh, wow.
And so we do have a golden statue of Thomas Paine in Paris.
Wow.
And there is a golden statue of Thomas Paine in his birthplace in Thetford, England. Mm-hmm. We would not be putting up a golden statue. It would be bronze.
That's the one thing also. I look forward to the day when it's on the fiat money, or the silver money, I think it should be, in gold we trust, not in gold we trust.
Well, I mean, I think your comments about the Biden inauguration are interesting to me. I actually wrote an op-ed for an outlet called Religion Dispatches on why I found that problematic. And I thought that when you invoke religion at times of national unity and healing, it's counterproductive because religion only unites its adherents. It is designed to exclude everybody else. It's an in-group, out-group phenomenon. It's an identity. And so when Biden and a number of the senators, and you have prayers at the inauguration, and he's calling for unity, you know, multiple times in his inaugural address, but he's continually invoking religion, he's leaving out the 85 million Americans that are non-religious. And the divisiveness that is inherent in religion is one of the reasons that our founding fathers chose to keep state and church separate in the first place.
Yes.
Because when you are relying, when you have a democratic government that depends on reasoned and rational debate and compromise to succeed, you can't inject religion into that or you're going to grind it to a halt. And we've seen that happen throughout American history. There have been waves of religious fervor that have kind of forced our government into to moments of crisis. I mean, to back up just a little bit and bring it back to Thomas Paine, and especially common sense, he was fighting against the weight of history with his argument, which is makes it all the more remarkable that he was so successful. You know, the common sense begins with one of my favorite quotes of all time. The second clause of the first sentence reads, "A long habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives it a superficial appearance of being right and raises at first a formidable outcry in defense of custom. But the tumult soon subsides. Time makes more converts than reason." And I love that. And I also think he kind of disproved it in a way. He was so successful with his argument. But yes, overall, he did so much to help form and create the American identity. And as his later writings would show, really helped to fight for sort of the separation of religion and government.
Right. Well, he wrote across, his writing was so clear that people across the spectrum, if you will, could understood it. Almost, you know, instantly, if you will, or they could grasp what he meant right down to fundamentals.
The other thing about the inauguration that many people do not understand is that the presidential oath of office, you know, the only oath that is detailed in the Constitution, it does not contain the phrase, "So help me God."
Right.
And that is not a requirement. And it is not a requirement to swear in a Bible. You can have an option of what you want to swear an oath on. I would choose the rights of man or the common sense or the age of reason. That would be my book of choice.
Sure.
But people don't understand that this is an option. I don't know if it's talked about prior to the delivery of an oath. But I certainly would hope that our politicians are aware of this, that you do not have to say, "So help me God."
Or you have to inform them about that, Margaret and Andrew, in a good way.
I think, yes. Well, and I should say the Freedom From Religion Foundation wrote President-elect Biden a letter explaining the history of our oath, the language of the oath that's laid out in Article 2, and where this sort of modern tradition of adding "So help me God" comes from. The tradition of using the Bible dates to Washington. It's not completely unanimous throughout our history. For instance, John Quincy Adams swore on a stack of law books. But "So help me God" being added to the presidential oath is much, much more recent tradition. It really only dates to the U.S. on the brink of entering World War I in 1917. And I also published an op-ed last week for the Progressive magazine, which details that, which draws on a lot of the research that I did for my book, The Founding Myth, which I really cover in probably excruciating detail the history of presidential inaugurations using that phrase. It's fascinating to me because the "So help me God," the idea, most people think that "So help me God" was dates to George Washington, which is not true. And that myth actually stems from a story that Washington Irving told. And if you remember Washington Irving, he's the guy who gave America Rip Van Winkle and the Headless Horseman. He kind of built a lot of American mythology, including this lie about Washington saying "So help me God" during the inaugural oath.
A short question there, Andrew. When you talked about that, we start using it in a brink of war, and the podcast and also Blair's blog is called The Secular Foxhole. And we had a discussion about that. Everyone understands what that meaning is, the foxhole. Is it a fox or is it military or could it be both? And how could you be a secular individual in military? And I asked that as an American in spirit, but, you know, and I've started work in America, but I am located in Europe. Wondering if you're a non-religious person or as you say, a free thinker in the military, how does that go along? Do you feel pressure that you have to put the hand on the Bible when it's war action or when you are in a foxhole or this kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And at FFRF, you know, I mentioned that we have 33,000 members and that our members are how we fund our work. A quarter, 25% of our members are active duty or veteran.
Wow.
So we have a huge proportion that we know are free thinkers who are involved in the military. And I have heard from many of them anecdotally that they do feel pressure, that the command structure, and especially the chaplain corps in all branches of the military, do put pressure on these individuals. Everybody already understands that the military, there's a huge amount of pressure and coercion built into the command structure. But they do feel pressure to be more religious and to adhere more. One of them told me, though, and this quote will always stick with me, he said, you know, he was in a lot of foxholes and he had a lot of atheist friends who were in there with him. And the one thing that he never saw in a foxhole was a chaplain.
Ah, okay.
Very good.
Interesting. Well,
1 year on Veterans Day, I set up a public venue in front of the Chester County Courthouse to celebrate atheists in foxholes.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a big banner that said, yes, there are atheists in foxholes. And there was so much hatred from people driving by and, you know, giving us obscene gestures.
Of course.
But this is part of educating the public. We need to be out there. We need to fight against ceremonial deism because it just perpetuates this myth that the United States is a Christian nation, and it's not. I don't like the "In God We Trust" on our money. I detest that it was put into the pledge at 1954 under God, and you know all of these things, these so-called innocuous ceremonial deism attempts really have done a lot of damage to the United States in regards to stereotyping and discrimination against anyone who doesn't believe in God.
And you even had that, you know, as I said to Blair, prayer meeting in Washington, in the White House.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, the White House Bible study, is that what you're referring to? Or
yeah, or even like a special meeting groups that they hold hand on the former president, and maybe they will do that on now also.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, as we talk about religion in the military too, and it reminds me of some of the things that Thomas Paine said. You know, he later wrote that an army of principles will penetrate where an army of soldiers cannot. Okay.
That's brilliant.
It is, and it captures the importance of what he did to solidify in the American mind at the time the need for independence and the ability of the nascent country to actually win the war against Britain. And I mean, John Adams, you know, kind of begrudgingly admitted later on that this time would actually be called the Age of Pain because of Paine's influence. And he said, without the pen of the author of Common Sense, the sword of Washington would have been raised in vain, which, you know, I mean,
that's
again,
powerful.
It is. And I mean, this is John Adams, who was not Paine's most greatest champion.
Didn't Washington read a bit of Thomas Paine at Valley Forge or some battle? I forget, honestly.
Thomas Paine's American Crisis papers were circulated throughout the Revolutionary War to troops in order to garner support for the cause when things were dire for the troops. The papers, the crisis papers, was so prolific and wonderful that it inspired these troops to continue. Washington ordered that these papers be read to the troops as far and wide. And there is a statue of Thomas Paine, by the way, in New Jersey, in Morristown, New Jersey. And you see him depicted sitting in front of a drum and writing on the drum his papers, The American Crisis, and across his lap is a musket that just conveys the dedication he had to the Revolutionary War. He was in the Revolutionary War, not only as a writer, but he would jump on his horse and travel long distances to get his papers into the hands of the troops.
He was a soldier. He was an aide to General Nathanael Greene. And I believe the specific battle that you were thinking of was before George Washington ordered the Continental Army to cross the Delaware, basically on that Christmas battle where they defeat the Hessians at the Battle of Trenton, this decisive victory. Washington did order that the American Crisis be read aloud, that's the one that begins, "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will in this crisis shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands by it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered." I mean, if you're a soldier about to go into battle, like that's some good stuff. That'll keep you warm as you cross the icy Delaware River. And they won. And I mean, and that was certainly a turning point, at least in the, again, the mental landscape of the American people at the time. It had been a pretty rough war, not many victories to point to. And that really kind of roused the national spirit along with Paine's word.
And we can't forget also something very important about Thomas Paine. Thomas Paine, before he even published Common Sense, he was the editor or a co-editor of the Philadelphia Magazine. And in there, he was able to talk about the things that he had hoped to better humankind. He was one of the very first abolitionists writing an article, African Slavery in America, and how horrible it was to actually sell and own human beings. He also talked about women's rights and even rights of animals. He was so ahead of his time that he should be honored for paving the way for Social Security and public schools. And even the United Nations gives a bow to Thomas Paine because of his thoughtful writings encouraging people to form such an organization.
Well, yeah, my next question would have been, since you brought those things up, how is Paine's work still relevant today?
Yeah, I mean, I think Margaret is right. Like he was so far ahead of his time. And I think, you know, if you go to Washington, D.C. today, there is a portrait of Thomas Paine in the National Gallery. They also have a tiny engraving that they don't display. There's no statue. There's no memorial. There's nothing to remember the man who convinced Americans to claim their independence. There's nothing for the man who named the United States of America. And I think a big part of the reason that he has essentially been deliberately erased from our history is because he made these powerful enemies along the way with his progressive views, including all the things that Margaret was talking about and things that we take for granted today, like Social Security, but also abolition and gender equality, universal women's suffrage, and then, of course, his writings on religion. And to me, this is something that absolutely needs to be rectified. And, you know, even with Trump's absurd Garden of the American Heroes, where he's going to put up these 250 statues that he announced by executive order on his way out the door, right? I mean, 250 names from people like Ansel Adams, you know, photographer, basically every Catholic saint that was ever in America, you know, all these different people. And even there was no room for Thomas Paine. And I think this is, we have come to realize so many of his dreams. The things that he was fighting for before they were even close to the mainstream are commonplace now. And that alone would deserve recognition, you know, apart from his contributions to the existence of the United States of America.
Well, for me, to speak again for myself, I think both sides, if you will, seem to be in a headlong rush to erase America's Enlightenment heritage. And
we have something going on here in the United States called Christian nationalism.
Sure.
And it is, you know, a rewrite of history. It is an attempt to embed Christianity via laws, and even constitutional amendments are being tried. We're in a battle for the democracy. And like Biden said, the soul of America. This is going to be a long, hard battle as we see people taking up arms who are believers in the Confederacy still. I mean, this is a tough, tough time for the United States. And with the words of Thomas Paine being spread that may help even in this crisis, I am not a sunshine soldier. I've been fighting for separation of religion and government for 30 years. And I think we can inspire other people to do so by enlightening them about the words of Thomas Paine and his work and his life.
That's great, Margaret. Margaret and Andrew, if it's possible, could you share a bit more about the details about the statues? They are not, will not be then, sorry to say, then in gold. And also what your kind of campaigns or guerrilla marketing and so on are you trying to do? Because we have other statues, for example, these Ten Commandments where you're fighting against and others. Because like here in Gothenburg, Sweden, we have a statue of a very famous newspaper man that's fought both against the National Socialists, Nazi Germany, and communists. And there it was internal censorship during the time, because they thought this kind of voice should be a bit quiet. Mm-hmm. Even between, you know, mainstream media. Mm-hmm. And there they have the obelisk with a pen, a symbolic pen, in central of Gothenburg, with mm-hmm. talking about birds flying freely in the sky. And it's so powerful. I mean, not many people knows about it, but it's there in a central place. So could you tell a bit more about that, and if it's a certain launch date or and how yes. we could promote it?
Well, we are so fortunate to have a world-famous sculptor working on the full-size version of Thomas Paine. Nice. He has submitted a first draft to us via a mini sculpture, and he has Thomas Paine's coat blowing in the wind and a quill in one hand and a document in the other. And our sculptor's name, if anyone is interested in looking at his past works that are very famous around the world, his name is Zenos, Zenos, Frudakis, Frudakis. And if you Google him, you'll see his studio is located in Pennsylvania. He has done some marvelous work for the Freedom From Religion Foundation as well. Would you like to talk about that, Andrew?
Yes. He's done some fantastic work on our awards, our being FFRF's awards. You can see some photos on our website, the Forward Award. Actually, Margaret, I was just thinking when I gave that talk to the Free Thought Society, I don't remember when that was. It was a few months ago now. And, you know, it was virtual. It was a Zoom talk. So I could see into everybody's living room who had their camera on. They could see into my office. And Zenos was there in his studio joining the call and sculpting a bust of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, one of my heroes. And it was so distracting because I'm watching this this amazing world-renowned sculptor sculpt one of my heroes and then trying to give a talk about Christian nationalism and why it's un-American at the same time. And it's really fascinating. But he's just a remarkably talented artist. And I would really encourage everybody to go check out his work. It's amazing. And he's got sculptures all around the world at this point.
Well, we'll certainly put his name in our show notes, along with links and everything that are available for him. Andrew, can you go into a little bit more about your book?
Sure. So the book is called The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. It's essentially trying to take on this existential threat to the American Republic, Christian nationalism, and undermine and destroy and completely undo its identity. its identity is based on disinformation. So reality is something of a threat to Christian nationalism. And what I try to do in the book is give everybody better facts, the real facts about American history, but then better arguments to fight back against Christian nationalism. You know, previous books have kind of done this really good job of explaining, we're not really a Christian nation because here's what the founding fathers actually said. Here's what they actually meant. Here's what the history tells us. And if you look at things in context, you know, this, but that hasn't really advanced our argument against Christian nationalism, which has grown stronger in the face of those books. And I came from a more unique perspective, having spent a decade arguing against Christian nationalism in the courts of public opinion and in debates and things like that. So I know what arguments work rather than just pointing to certain facts. For instance, the Treaty of Tripoli, which is great and the language is admirably clear, but it doesn't really advance our cause that much. So what I basically did was I asked a deeper question than the typical one you hear, which is the United States a Christian nation? Instead, I asked, did Judeo-Christian principles, whatever those may be, positively influence the founding of the United States of America? And the answer to that is no, they didn't. And in fact, Judeo-Christian principles, and especially those that are central to the Christian nationalist identity, are fundamentally opposed to the principles that founded the United States. So what I'm arguing is that Christian nationalism and the American founding represent two irreconcilable sets of principles, that they are fundamentally opposed to one another, and that because of those irreconcilable differences, the founders chose to separate state and church. I mean, thinking of it another way, America will never be a Christian nation, because the moment it becomes a Christian nation, it will cease to be America.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Yes. His book is fantastic. Please post a link to his book if you can.
Oh, sure, if absolutely.
Listeners can take advantage of reading that. Is it available audio, Andrew?
It is. It's an audio book. I have to say, I have warned people, I didn't get a chance to read it myself. I'm a little salty and bitter about it, but I'll refrain from there's an audiobook version, there's an ebook, there's a hardback available wherever fine books are sold.
All right.
Great.
Good. Wow. Can you is the Thomas Paine Memorial Association, is that .org, or do you have a website?
So no, this is like the first time we've talked about it and announced it, and we're getting everything up and running. So people are going to have to stay tuned for how to donate and contribute and where to get more information on that. Margaret and I are working behind the scenes with the rest of the board. Margaret didn't mention in the beginning that she's president of the Thomas Paine Memorial Association. She singled me out as treasurer, neglecting to mention that she is our fearless leader. So, just want to add that.
Oh, thank you. But we have some wonderful co-sponsors right now. We are so proud to have Robin Blumner as a board member. She is the CEO for the Center for Inquiry. And Roy Speckhard is representing the American Humanist Association. And of course, our wonderful supporters for this project are Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker, who are co-presidents of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. So, we're going to be advertising this effort through our publications. We're going to be circulating pictures of how the statue project is coming along. We're just announcing this today that this will be our, we should open a bottle of champagne or something.
Right.
Because we've never talked about it before. So this is a first.
Well, I'll drink to that.
Thanks for sharing this.
Yes.
Do you think it has international importance also, that we should spread the word around the globe? Because of course, the main part of our listeners are in the United States of America, but also in Europe, but also in like India and other places.
Well, Thomas Paine is a hero to so many countries. The Irish love Thomas Paine. Mm-hmm. When I did a walking tour in Paris, it was just amazing how loved he is there and how much people know about him. But he also is used the The Rights of Man is the book that really encourages citizen involvement with overthrowing tyranny, especially tyranny of the crown. So any place that there is this strife, the Rights of Man pops up and is read by many people as they try to become independent and democratic.
I think Paine himself answered this question when he said, my country is the world and my religion is to do good.
Yes.
Very basic things, yes.
He was a citizen of the world.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, listen, I sort of wrap things up. I want to thank you for appearing on the show and also for granting us the privilege of for you to make the announcement on our show about the Thomas Paine Memorial Association. We thank you for that. And making notes to myself for the show, I thought about asking you both back, say in June, to discuss more thoroughly the separation of church and state for like a, if we can, we might post that on July 4th, so to speak.
Well, what's going to be wonderful is that on June the 8th of this year, we are going to have an international Zoom celebration of Thomas Paine's life and work. And we choose the date of June 8th as Thomas Paine Day because he died on June 8th. Okay. And traditionally, many other countries celebrate someone's life on the date of their death. But it's also kind of a selfish reason in that the weather is horrible in January, the date that he was born. So I started in 1996 to proclaim June 8th as Thomas Paine Day because I wanted to have not only celebrations, but parades and, you know, be outdoors and educate the public by doing some really great festivities surrounding Thomas Paine. And fortunately, I've been able to do that several times on June 8th. So let's continue the tradition. We're going to be sending out an invitation for June 8th, and people all over the world can log on. It will be a celebration that will disclose information about his entire life. And it'll be very interesting because we're going to have a lot of trivia in there that people probably don't know.
Wow. All right.
I'm happy to come back on and talk about state church separation or the founding fathers or American independence, any of that stuff, anytime. I love it. I'm happy to do it.
That sounds great. Good. Awesome. Well, ladies and gentlemen,
I would like to come back and talk about Robert Greene Ingersoll sometime.
Well, yes. See, I'm going to write all this down now. I have to get busy here. Write it down. We've been talking to Margaret Downey of the Free Thought Society, and I'm hoping I pronounced your name right, Andrew. Andrew Seidel or Seidel?
Seidel. But I'm not picky.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. The Freedom From Religion Foundation. Martin and I thank you for both for visiting the Foxhole today.
Thank you. Keep up the great work.
Wow. Thank you. Well, that's a wrap.
That's a wrap. Yep.